This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
I bought a small book for 25 cents.
Bob Priest.
I have a different religious tradition from my own, entitled The Intellectual Life, Its Spirit, Conditions, and Methods by the Dominican Sertilanges. There I furtively read and reread his call and description of the vocation of the intellectual life, gradually learned tendencies to frame research writing and scholarship as worldly, prideful, self-seeking, and thus a temptation to be resisted or replaced with the recognition that God may well call many of us to lives of service in which research and scholarship become part of a God-honoring life. I assume today that I'm speaking to people like me for whom scholarship generally in social science, and your particular social science more specifically, is a core element in your own sense of calling, or our own sense of vocation. Vocation, of course, carries with it the idea, number one, that our work is congruent with our gifts and training. Two, that our work is directed towards ends that we ourselves personally value, ends which themselves, three, are anchored within a larger system of transcendent meanings, understandings, and values. To have a sense of vocation is a wonderful thing. Duty and desire potentially merge, becoming one thing. Our life has unity, coherence, purpose, and meaning. And yet, such unity and coherence are in practice difficult to achieve. Our lives are often filled with disparate elements, competing obligations, and lack of congruence between the different parts of our lives. So that even when we embrace a vocational commitment within the framework of our social science, actually constructing lives of coherence, balance, and unity in which our social science plays a central role while nonetheless anchored within a larger system of transcendent meanings and values, Christian meanings and values, must be a practical accomplishment, perhaps never more than partially achieved. In the last 8 to 10 years, I've interviewed 70 Christian anthropologists about their lives and transcribe the interviews. As I've read and reread the transcripts of these interviews, I've been struck by how many of the people I interviewed indicate that they feel, many of them late in life, that they failed to construct lives that were both centered in their discipline, active success within the discipline, but also characterized by coherence, unity, and balance fostered by their Christian faith, and who often express deep regrets over this late in life. Their struggle to construct coherent and integrated lives as scholars appears to be directly related to the sociological reality that our intellectual work is socially situated, not solitary, and that Christians often find that optimum integration requires strong social links and supports from two rather diverse social communities. A disciplinary community which largely operates out of secularist assumptions, and the Christian community, which often lacks appreciation for the strategic value of the human sciences. I would like, in our time together, to reflect on the challenges of creating coherent unity in our vocations as Christian scholars in the human sciences, challenges directly connected with the need for integration between diverse conceptual worlds of two different social communities. That of our discipline, our disciplinary community, which provides optimum supports for high-quality scholarship, but which largely reflects secularist assumptions, and that of our Christian faith communities that are explicitly attempting to make God and His Word the integrating factor for thought and life, but which largely fail to understand the issues and challenges that Christians face in the human sciences. I'll organize my thoughts around my own experiences, struggling with tensions and challenges of striving towards a life of unity, coherence, and balance in a way which retains a central place for anthropology itself. I'm an anthropologist. I focus on my own experience not because it is exemplary, but simply because I know it best, and I hope that reflections on that experience will provide a catalyst for each one here to think about parallel experiences and struggles you face in your social setting. I love anthropology, and I find my calling before God in being an anthropologist. I didn't begin my academic life in anthropology. Rather, I began with a four-year undergraduate major in Bible and theology, followed by 3 years of seminary. I applied for and was accepted to do further graduate work in New Testament at Princeton, but deferred matriculation for 18 months to pursue my relationship with a young woman from California who was teaching in West Virginia and who now teaches sociology at Wheaton College. So I'm an anthropologist married to a sociologist. While in West Virginia, I took an interim position as assistant pastor and youth director. After 7 years studying Bible and theology, my shelves were lined with commentaries, and I was ready to preach. I felt I had mastered the tools I needed to understand the Bible and proclaim its truth. And initially, I felt pretty good about my own preaching. But as time progressed, I became increasingly disturbed by the contrast between my knowledge of Scripture and my lack of knowledge of the lives of those to whom I spoke. I had grown up far from Bluefield. My parents were Wycliffe missionaries in Bolivia. And I had little understanding of the lives of wealthy country club Presbyterian elders, a deficiency my education did not correct. I could apply the Bible to myself and to other people in full-time Christian ministry, but to almost no one else. I could talk about the love of money being the root of all sorts of evil, and I could explore the resultant evils in the lives of Bible characters, like Achan, Balaam, Gehazi, or Judas. But I had no idea what kinds of evil the love of money might be producing in the lives of Mrs. Coughlin, Mr. Fuschenberger, or Mrs. Breath. I could quote James 3:16, that where you have envy, there you have every evil practice. And I could show you how envy resulted in evil practices for Bible characters like Cain, Joseph's brothers, who of course envied his coat of many colors, or King Saul, when the women started singing about David's exploits rather than his. But I had little understanding of what evil practices envy might be producing among teenaged girls in Bluefield High School. And since my Christian community had frowned on Christians watching movies, I was unable even to explore envy at the movies, such as Salieri's Envy of Mozart and Amadeus. I could see what was obvious, that Bluefield was divided by railroad tracks, with blacks in relative poverty on one side of the tracks and whites in comparative wealth on the other. But I did not understand what patterns of human agency had produced and sustained what was obvious in terms of what I could see. The people I was with had very different backgrounds from my own. We had different life experiences, had been shaped by different cultural discourses, and pursued different life trajectories. I did not understand their fears, frustrations, moral challenges, hopes, and dreams. One day I picked up John Stott's book, Between Two Worlds, in which he argues that effective preaching requires a deep understanding both of the world of Scripture and of the contemporary lives of those to whom we speak. Effective preaching, he says, builds a bridge of understanding across the chasm between these two worlds. According to Stott, only preachers who ground their work in deep and profound understandings of Scripture, and also deep and profound understandings of the life worlds of their audience, are able adequately to fulfill their calling. He suggests in this book that many theological liberals, he claimed, grounded their sermons in understandings of the contemporary world. They build bridges in which that are anchored on one side of the chasm. But he argued that many failed to trust the Scriptures and thus failed to ground their sermons in a biblical God-given message. Their sermons, he said, build bridges that look like this. They do not connect both sides. But, Stott continued, evangelical preachers typically preach sermons grounded in Scripture, but he says, which go up in the air on a straight trajectory and never land on the other side. For our preaching, he said, is seldom, if ever, earthed. It fails to build a bridge into the contemporary world. So I read Stott's book. My next sermon, about 3 or 4 weeks down the line, was supposed to be on the gospel in response to death. Following Stott's advice, I prepared both with Scripture and by trying to understand discourses and experiences of death which my audience would have been shaped by and aware of. I read psychologists, literary scholars, and sociologists. I talked to people about death. I collected quotes from a local funeral home, from at that time the recent TV show Fame, from Woody Allen, novelists, and so on. And when I preached my sermon, something startling happened. people of all sorts who had never spoken to me about anything personal came up and they were ready to talk. And as we talked, what became clear was that the message, a biblical message, had touched them in a way my other sermons had not, because it brought the gospel meaningfully into engagement with their culturally shaped experiences, anxieties, discourses, and responses to death. During my 18 months at Bluefield, I became increasingly convinced that John Stott was correct to insist that effective ministry required deep understandings of contemporary human realities, but also increasingly and uncomfortably aware that I lacked adequate tools to consistently forge deep understandings of the human realities I was wishing to address through Scripture. Furthermore, I understood Stott to be saying that my weaknesses were not mine alone, but were common to the evangelical community of which I was a product. Proverbs 19:2 tells us, it is not good to have zeal without knowledge, nor to be hasty and miss the way. It is not good for surgeons or pilots or air traffic controllers to have zeal without knowledge, nor is it good for pastors or parents or professors to have zeal without knowledge. And the sorts of knowledge needed, according to Stott, included both knowledge of Scripture and knowledge of our contemporary world. I personally thus underwent a period of prayerful soul-searching, eventually concluding that God would have me orient my study plans away from further work in New Testament and towards the human sciences. And so I pursued first a master's degree in social science at the University of Chicago, and then a PhD in anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. At the University of Chicago, I joined a community of social scientists. Very different community than I'd ever lived with before. And I was introduced to whole new discursive worlds. The discontinuities between the social communities and discursive worlds could not have been more jarring for me. As the months progressed, I realized I could either experience a conversion, where I abandoned my prior community and its discourses, fully embracing the new community and its discourses as the organizational frame for my life and for understanding. Or I could move back and forth between communities and simply switch categories, discourses, assumptions, depending on whether I was at the American Anthropology Association or an adult Sunday school class, while schizophrenically keeping my understandings in these two arenas in separate compartments. Or I could grapple intellectually with how Christians' assumptions and understandings ought to be brought into engagement with the human sciences. I chose to pursue the third route. During my first year at Chicago, my wife was rather disturbed that I was spending at least a third of my time reading things that weren't assigned, reading Christian intellectuals and theologians, desperately trying to find help in gaining a perspective by others who had gone before me in grappling with the issues of how to put things together, yes, as a Christian. I must confess, however, that while this was helpful, it was also frustrating, because while evangelical theologians often have provided sophisticated help in reflecting on philosophy, I could find none who provided sophisticated help in assessing and reflecting on social theory. The issue this raises for me came into focus just a few years ago when a group of faculty from Wheaton College and Trinity Evangelical Divinity School regularly met to discuss various books focused on race and ethnicity. It was the activities of this group that eventually led to the Oxford publication that I co-edited with Dr. Nieves, This Side of Heaven, Race, Ethnicity, and Christian Faith. On one particular day, all of us had read the theologian Miroslav Volf's book, Exclusion and Embrace, A Theological Explanation of Identity, Otherness, and Reconciliation. Dr. Kevin Van Hooser, a theologian, and Dr. Hank Allen, an African-American sociologist with a PhD from the University of Chicago, were to deliver formal responses to the book. Most in the room were excited about this book, thrilled that a theologian was validating this topic as worthy of focus, and the conversation commenced with deeply appreciative comments. But when Dr. Allen stood with 20-plus pages of handwritten notes, he launched into a startling and rather blistering critique, telling us he only had time to enumerate a few of the book's weaknesses. He suggested that for a scholar based in the United States to write about this topic and virtually ignore the American experience of race, to write about Christian responses to oppression while ignoring the response of African-American Christians, and to write as if racial ideologies grounded in color were not relevant to the discussion of modern identities, were all serious deficiencies. He suggested that during decades when evangelical theologians ignored social realities related to sinful racial patterns, sociologists and anthropologists, often with deep moral concern, were the ones, or among the ones, who empirically studied and wrote about ethnic and racial realities, redlining practices, housing covenants, Jim Crow laws, miscegenation laws, ideologies of biological race, and so on. One would naturally expect, then, Dr. Allen suggested, that when a theologian finally decided that the subject of ethnic identities and otherness merited attention, that he would respectfully build on and interact with the hard-won understandings of social scientists. Instead, Dr. Allen observed, Wolf ignored social scientists and excluded them as conversation partners while embracing instead philosophers and literary figures such as Nietzsche, Derrida, or Ricoeur as his preferred conversation partners, most of whom had never made ethnicity or race central to their own work. This, Dr. Allen indicated, was a principal reason for the book's many weaknesses and blind spots. As Dr. Allen spoke, I quickly browsed through the index, the bibliography, and the section headings. I mean, I just read the book, startled to realize that he was pointing things out that I had not even noticed, but which, indeed, appeared to be true. But even if Wolf's book, despite its concern with otherness, is Eurocentric, even if it completely neglects African-American experience, even if it prefers interaction with philologists over sociologists, and even if there's results in major blind spots, why, some of our faculty audience was wondering, did Dr. Allen refer to these matters with more than a hint of indignation? Brian, were you there for that event? Okay. There's a little tension here. A part of the answer for Dr. Allen, as he explained, was that Wolf's refusal to constructively engage the social sciences exemplified, Dr. Allen claimed, in a particularly egregious form, given the subject matter, a widespread characteristic, he suggested, of evangelical theology. And he said, this must be forcefully confronted. As I considered Dr. Allen's comments, I reflected on evidences I was aware of that might support his generalization. For example, I thought about the writings of the great Christian philologist C.S. Lewis and his denigration of sociology. The hero of C.S. Lewis's science fiction is the philologist Ransom, while the wimpy sociologist Mark Studdock is mocked for false pretensions to knowledge and insight. Lewis's fictional demon Screwtape tells his nephew Wormwood that students should be kept away from the physical sciences because physical science leads people to God. So here's Wormwood saying, get them to study science, and then they'll become secular and atheist. And Screwtape says, no, you know, that's God's world out there. If they go into physical science, they might become Christian. Stay away from physical science. So the nephew, Wormwood, says, well, what should they study if they really want to study? Said Screwtape, have them study sociology and economics, disciplines presumably safely in the devil's kill. I decided to explore Dr. Allen's claim a little more systematically. Since theologians do focus on human realities, especially under the two topics of theological anthropology and of hamartiology, the theology of sin, where one might naturally expect discussion of culture, race, ethnicity, gender, or sexuality, I spent several days browsing through every systematic theology book on these two topics in Trinity's library, looking carefully at what sorts of scholarship they interacted with. And while these theologians interacted extensively with philosophy and to some extent the humanities, I could find no evidence of any evangelical systematic theologian writing on these topics who had systematically read and engaged cultural anthropology or sociology. That is, Wolf is not alone in his habits. And indeed, I discovered a significant number from Kenneth Kanzer. I mean, these are many of these my heroes, a former professor of mine, to John Milbank and a host of Milbank's followers, who were not only silent on the human sciences, but who actively warned Christians away from making the social sciences a constructive dialogue partner. Take evangelical theologian Alistair McGrath, for example. In his 2001 Scientific Theology, Volume 1, page 20, he points out that historically theologians have made philosophy their dialogue partner, their ancilla theologia. And he sets forth his own proposal to make the physical sciences serve as a new dialogue partner for theologians, an ancilla theologia. No, he's read C.S. Lewis, physical science, good. But in a several-page disquisition, McGrath insists that the social sciences must not be allowed to play such a dialogue partner role. Like C.S. Lewis and John Milbank, he apparently considers them to reside in Satan's camp. Is it any wonder that social scientists like Dr. Allen might feel the need to forcefully and indignantly push back? It is interesting to contrast C.S. Lewis and Alistair McGrath on one side with Billy Graham and Martin Luther King on the other. Billy Graham was asked in an interview published nationally in the Sunday morning newspaper insert Parade if, when he looked back over his long life, he had any regrets. If you were to live your life again, is there anything you would do differently? Yes, he replied, I would have studied more. I would have gotten my Ph.D. in anthropology. When I read that, I was wondering what Americans were thinking across the country. In short, Graham regrets not zeal, but zeal without knowledge, in this case a special sort of knowledge, knowledge of the human, particularly in the context of cultural diversity and complexity. Like John Stott, he discovers that he needs an understanding both of Scripture and of the contemporary world of the people that he speaks to. Follow it. Let's just have fun for a minute. Follow Graham as he goes to India. Listen to him preach a sermon he preached many times before, but this time to a different audience, an audience of high-caste Brahmins. A wonderful story of a father's love for a wayward son who spends his inheritance in righteous living, and only when tempted to eat pig's food does he acknowledge his sin and return to his father, who hugs his son and calls for a robe and a ring. The audience loves the story, until the point where the evangelist tells of a fatted calf being killed and feasted on. The formerly appreciative audience turns cold and hostile, and Graham initially can't figure out why. The cow, people say, is like our mother. It gives nurturing milk. When does that kill and eat one's mother? We can perhaps appreciate the impact of the story if a foreign evangelist with a religious message were telling Americans a wonderful story. But we're at the height of the story, the hero inexplicably kills, barbecues, and eats the family's golden retriever. That is, such a person would have failed to understand the American sacred dog complex. Would have failed to understand the dog stories that shaped generations of Americans, stories of Lassie and Old Yeller. Would have failed to understand American proverbs about the dog being a man's best friend. That Americans like dogs in their homes, that they let them lick their faces or sleep in their beds, that they have dog cemeteries, dog doctors, dog hotels, dog therapists. That here, you can sometimes mistreat people and get away with it, but mistreat a dog, and even a professional football player will go to jail. Here there is no Kentucky Fried Canine, and while cultural entertainment relentlessly features people getting killed in bloody ways, such entertainment carefully respects taboos on displays of violence toward dogs. Years ago, my 11-year-old daughter Shelley asked me to see the movie Dante's Peak with her. The story features a volcano, a family, a dog, and a mother-in-law. As the volcano erupts and the family has to flee, the dog is nowhere to be found. The family has to leave anyway, and my daughter, a dog lover, was in tears. I turned to Shelley. Shelley, this is an American movie. That dog will not die. I promise. And sure enough, by the end of the movie, the dog is alive and the mother-in-law is dead. It's a good movie. People around the world are human in variable ways, shaped by variable cultural discourses, confronting diverse realities. Billy Graham, like John Stott, recognizes late in life that effective preaching requires both an understanding of the world of Scripture and an understanding of the human worlds of those to whom we speak. And unlike C.S. Lewis, Miroslav Volf, or Alistair McGrath, Graham recognizes that a discipline like anthropology or sociology can help one acquire deeper understandings of such contemporary realities. In the Parade magazine, Graham describes growing up in a Jim Crow American South, where he fully internalized the racialized prejudices of his community. He describes how his Wheaton College major, anthropology, had a profound impact on him, helping him begin to understand his racialized world in a whole new way. And while Graham, because of his Wheaton College major, was somewhat ahead of the curve compared to most evangelicals of his day in recognizing and resisting the human evils of a racialized society, he now recognizes just how little he adequately understood the human racial realities that organized and channeled so much human evil. His regret in not getting a PhD in anthropology, if you read his interview carefully, was not really a regret about a degree, a PhD. Or a regret that he was not a noted anthropology scholar rather than an evangelist, but rather a way of expressing his own subjective awareness both of how helpful he now recognizes anthropology to have been for his life as an evangelist and of how much he now wishes that he had appreciated that earlier and pursued such understandings further and more carefully. When the question was asked, "Do you have any regrets?" Graham's answer should not be heard simply as the idiosyncratic regret of an individual. Graham, in some ways, can be thought of as a prototypical evangelical of his day, honored for exemplifying many of our highest virtues. And when this man, reflecting on his own weaknesses in engaging his contemporary racialized society, this is simultaneously a confession about weaknesses in the wider, in this case, white evangelical community, exemplified in the failure of evangelical churches during the civil rights era of the 1950s and 60s. And when Graham expresses a regret for not having deeper and more profound understandings of human realities, this may appropriately be read as a call for the evangelical community as a whole to develop deeper and more profound understandings of the human worlds in which we live and work. Proverbs 19:2, it is not good to have zeal without knowledge, and the knowledge which is needed involves both biblical teaching and knowledge of the human worlds in which we live, whether of India, the Jim Crow South of the 1940s, or contemporary America in 2009. A while back, I asked a Trinity colleague who the two most influential preachers of the 20th century were. He replied that in very different arenas of influence, he guessed he would name Dr. Billy Graham and Dr. Martin Luther King. So one evangelism, one social engagement of great evil. Very interesting choices. Two men who grew up in the American South of the 1920s and 30s on opposite sides of the color line, one who majored in anthropology, and the other whose undergraduate major was sociology, both of whom would repeatedly, over the course of their lives, point back to the strategic foundations these disciplines played in their own formation. The fact remains that in many, perhaps most, evangelical theological seminaries that are given the task of preparing pastors and preachers, under the influence of theologians like John Milbank or Alistair McGrath, there is often a profound suspicion of the human sciences, which ensures that these sciences are marginal to pastoral preparation, and that pastoral church leaders are thus, in my opinion, poorly prepared to help lay Christians understand the value of the right sorts of human science. There's partial exceptions to this in pastoral counseling with psychology and to some extent missiology, where anthropology, my own job for that matter, does find a place. The social locations which provide the best supports for top quality social science research are, of course, the major research universities. I love the intellectual community I found as a graduate student in the anthropology departments at the University of Chicago and at Berkeley, the incredible library supports which were available, and the various other supports that were available for research and writing. But these communities also, and settings also, generated struggles for me, struggles to think through issues of relativism, struggles emotionally to process the rather consistent negative portrayals of Christians, missionaries, struggles to know how to manage my identity as an evangelical Christian in a community which rather consistently talked as if it were unthinkable that an evangelical Christian would actually be part of us. And of course, as already mentioned, I confronted challenges of how to intellectually put together my thinking in ways that were faithful to scripture, while also solidly anthropological and consistent with what could be empirically demonstrated to be true. In the following section, I would like to simply list a series of suggestions and observations about what is needed in Christian engagement with the human sciences, and hope that some of these prove helpful. First, the single most important thing needed, it seems to me, is simply Christians who are present in these disciplines in larger numbers than they currently are. Present in the sense that they are contributing through original research and writing to their field, and in the sense that a significant number are present in the social settings which are at the cutting edge of intellectual work in their field. And I'm thinking here particularly of the PhD granting institutions in these fields. George has done research recently that looks at bias within the disciplines, and he's told me that anthropologists are amongst the most biased against Christians around the country, which was really telling me something I didn't already feel like I knew. We have in our room today Dr. Robert Kenfield, a professor of anthropology at Washington University, so in a major doctoral granting institution of anthropology. But he may be the only evangelical Christian anthropologist in the whole country within a tenured professor within an anthropology department. This is very different from sociology, where you can, my wife, you know, I feel like she's so privileged. She's got Christian Smith and Robert Wuthnow and George Yancey and so on and so on. But even sociology could certainly do more. We need others. We need people simply in these fields, in central positions. In sociology, students who graduate with a BA and want to do doctoral work, immediately you can find scattered across the country people who might be good mentors for them and supportive of them. It's a little different in anthropology. We also need, of course, people whose social location is supportive of explicit discussions of how Christian faith ought to be integrated with the discipline. That is, there's some things that are hard to do publicly in a secular university that I can easily do in the seminary, or that in a Christian college like we can be done. I think we need both. Second, at one level, Christians should engage as wide a variety of research foci as are present in their discipline. There's not just a small subset of things that Christians should be doing research on. That is, being a Christian should not artificially limit your interests. My own research interests are rather diverse. I'm interested in witchcraft, recovered memories as they relate to reports of abuse, purification rituals, the use of the missionary position as a discursive symbol, etiology of adult missionary kid life struggles, short-term missions, racial dynamics in congregational settings, etc. In my own discipline, when a Tom Headland of the Summer Institute of Linguistics becomes a world authority on hunter-gatherer forest ecology, discussing and being featured, his theories being featured in Science and so on the impossibility of pure hunter-gatherers without in pure forest, rainforest ecology settings, are featured, or when the Dr. Robert Kenfield, world authority in Afghanistan, or Dr. Dean Arnold of Wheaton College, discovers how Maya blue paint was made. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you can go look at that great anthropological film, Apocalypto. Dr. Dean's discovery has just been celebrated, hot off the press. The January 2009 cover of Archaeology lists it, it's the cover story, and it lists it as the first of the 10 most important discoveries in archaeology of the year 2008. It's Dr. Dean Arnold at Christian College here. Such Christian presence at the cutting edge of research, the advance of knowledge, not on narrowly focused Christian topics, but on the full spectrum of whatever kinds of knowledge issues are being advanced. When this happens, this is an important service to Christian community's own presence and engagement in higher education, and is a key precondition for many other positive outcomes. Okay, next. It is important that we do research and writing designed to convince the Christian community at large of the importance and strategic value of the human sciences. On the one side, we need to develop sophisticated readings of our own Christian communities and work to counteract unhealthy attitudes toward the human sciences. We need rebuttals to the John Milbanks in the theological world, who suggests that theology and the human sciences are necessarily alternative and competing approaches. But we also need to do research on Christian practices and other topics of particular concern to Christians, drawing Christians into the value and the power of the human sciences by treating topics of interest to them with better insight and understanding than other people writing on them who have no social science background. For years, I treated short-term missions dismissively. I sneered at it. I quoted the missiologist that said, short-term missionaries are like dogs running through an art museum. They see everything and understand nothing. sometimes, like dogs, they urinate on sacred things. Okay. You can tell I wasn't friendly to short-term. Then I discovered that very few of the seminary students were planning to be career missionaries, but three-quarters of them had traveled abroad on short-term mission trips. I discovered this is core to the ways, at the popular level, that Christian churches are engaging across national and cultural and racial and so on lines. And I thought, I can't just be reactionary, I've got to do research. The value of anthropology is not just having a snobbish opinion about certain things, it's doing research. And so I decided to make this a subject of sustained research. And a number of others have as well, including Dr. Howell. I found this to be not only a great topic of research, but a topic which had people immediately clamoring for me to tell them what I had learned. In the last 2 years, I've been asked to speak over 20 times to all different audiences about my research on short-term missions, cumulatively speaking to over 4,000 people on short-term missions in those 20 times. Mission pastors, mission executives, professors, seminarians, etc. By focusing my research on a topic that a lot of Christians are familiar with and interested in, I'm able to develop through that an apologetic for the value of the human sciences by the very way in which I write and do research on this. 4, I believe it is important that we also intentionally pick research topics, at least periodically, that push us to reflect on the implications of Scripture and of our Christian faith for how we treat a given topic. The fact that Scripture does, the Bible doesn't just talk about God, it talks about people. I mean, there's a book that speaks to human realities. The fact is that Scripture does suggest many specific ideas about human realities. And part of being a faithful Christian, my understanding, is that we work very hard to attend to whatever Scripture teaches us and to grapple deeply with the question of how such biblical teaching ought to be related to our research. In my own research, I've chosen to struggle with the construct of conscience as it relates to Scripture, biblical teaching, and as it relates to cultural variability. I struggle to understand biblical treatments of marriage or sexuality at the same time as I study polygyny or the Berdash. As an experiment, I read a paper at the American Anthropology Association on the construct of sin and its value for field ethnography. A paper which Mark Ploss, a leading secular anthropologist of religion, found so provocative he wrote his own article with sustained elaboration of how such a research agenda organized around the construct of sin would be very fruitful, with both of our articles appearing together in print in an anthropology publication. That is, I believe it is an important exercise for each one of us, at least occasionally, to identify a research topic which is at least tangentially addressed through some aspect of theology or biblical teaching, and work hard to master the theological and biblical issues and debates in that area at the same time as we design and carry out our own research on the topic. It helps if we cultivate professional settings where we can interact with other Christian scholars about the subjects we examine and allow other Christians to push us in our thinking, to press us to consider how our Christian faith ought to influence our research and writing. How much of this will show up explicitly in your publications will doubtless depend on your social location, where you're publishing, and so on. 5, I do think that we need to take seriously the Christian doctrine of sin in relation to what theologians call the noetic effects of sin, that is, the knowledge effects of sin. Sometimes when people talk about sin, they think it's only about sex. But the knowledge effects of sin suggests that people work out their rejection of God not only in what they do with their genitals, but in what they do with their minds and in their scholarship. That is, it's possible to work out your own rejection of God in the intellectual anthropological work that you do. E.B. Tyler, the father of modern anthropology, theologians all to expose. 'Tis the mission of primitive man. What he was saying is, the mission, i.e. my mission, in studying primitive man is to undercut the worldview of theologians, i.e. Christian theologians. So, there's a motivated dimension to human sciences. Thus, we need to have a critical sense vis-a-vis our own disciplines, being attentive to how biases about God, about religion, about Christianity, about morality, about sexuality, etc., shape and affect the field. We are not researching things that are unrelated to the self. We are researching things that we are deeply invested in terms of how we understand. A critical stance by Christians who are not practitioners of the discipline is sometimes counterproductive. If you have someone who simply is saying anthropology or sociology is bad, and they have never done it themselves and they're not a part of it, this has a lot of negative effects for those of us who are Christians in these fields. But if you have leading, if you have anthropologists, sociologists who are themselves contributing to their field, you are contributing positively, not just negatively, through research. You're active researchers and scholars, but you also occasionally are, as part of your research and writing, saying, like Dr. Yancey, I'm going to just do a study with thousands of professors across the disciplines and ask them, let's see if I can even remember what I was told here, but ask them, if someone came and applied to your department, would this factor, if you found out about this, would this be a plus or a negative? What if you found out they were partly, a member of the NRA? Is that what it is? What if you found out they were an evangelical? What if you found out, so doing research, and I'm really looking forward to the research results as they're published. Dr. Brian Howell has a very fascinating article, The Repugnant Other Speaks Back. Is that the title? In the journal
Anthropological Theory,
where he, as a Christian, writing in a secular journal, picks up on another anthropologist who calls evangelicals or fundamentalist Christians the repugnance of such another. And Brian says, okay, you talk about how we on the field deal with those repugnant others in our field work, and you assume that none of us is anthropologists of that. What if, and Brian says, I'm one of those people talking back to you now. Now, how do you deal with me as a peer? I myself have attempted twice to try and document such biases in the field. Once in my May thesis at the University of Chicago, Functionalist Anthropology and the Criticism of Missionaries, and once in an article, Missionary Positions, Christian Modernists and Postmodernists. Surprisingly, while I was documenting bias against Christianity within my discipline was also able and willing to create the space for me to make the case. The University of Chicago honored my thesis with the Roland Nestor Johnson Prize and asked me to speak at the annual banquet, the Divisional Masters in Social Sciences program. And the leading international journal of anthropology, Current Anthropology, not only published my article, but arranged for 14 leading anthropologists to write responses to my article while giving me a chance to respond to them. The human sciences are fully human. There are biases that work themselves out in the discipline, but these disciplines are reality-based. They're not simply science fiction, fantasy. There are standards to which we can appeal and operate, and it is quite possible, even for Christians, if done very carefully and wisely, to engage in ways, in this case, where I explicitly identified myself as an evangelical Christian, picking up on postmodernist trends in anthropology, on position knowledge, to carry on what I felt like was a very productive interaction. Finally, we need to recognize intellectual work is social work, a sort of conversation with others where we learn from others, critique others, generate research and writing designed to further conversation. For the Christian, we must become self-conscious about building social and intellectual ties in two directions. Both doing what every other scholar does, which is to master and become embedded in the conversations and networks of our professional guild, but also recognizing that intellectual work as a Christian also requires similar social networks and supports. It's not enough to be nurturing in the public way this intellectual side, the discipline side of your life, while trying at the private level, just having devotions every morning and then maybe interacting with Christians in Sunday school who have no idea of your world. We need to have kinds of networks and connections and readings and conversation partners that are pushing us on the side of Christian intellectual engagement. We need to find Christians who are scholars, who address issues directly related to our interests, and very intentionally look for help with the intellectual side of our Christian engagement. This should affect the sorts of literature, reviews we do as we carry out the foundation of any research program that we're starting. It should affect the kinds of conferences or sessions we attend, the kinds of intellectual friends we cultivate, and so on. So, one more thought. When our research and writing are aligned to the priorities and values of wider communities, it is likely that we will receive both greater support and greater recognition for the value of our work. When I first taught in a seminary in South Carolina, my expertise was lowland South American indigenous populations, and I wanted to discuss ecological adaptation in the rainforest. My students were seminary students and were not planning to live in the rainforest of Peru or Bolivia. That is, my students couldn't care less. On the other hand, there was an intense conversation about spiritual warfare on campus. People had read Frank Peretti and others. And it was affecting how students were viewing other cultures and shamanism and so on in ways that actually were disturbing to me. So I chose to seek funding for an interdisciplinary group of faculty to engage and critique these populist discourses. Other faculty, psychologists and others, were energized. Students signed up. And when I presented at the National Missiology meeting and published, it created a rather large amount of interest. It was not a topic I would have picked to start with. But I said, here's my community. Everybody's talking about, is there something anthropological that I can contribute to this? Similarly, as a Wycliffe missionary kid, the child of parents from Mississippi and South Carolina, but who had grown up abroad, I frankly knew very little about race in America. And then I went to teach in South Carolina, where the Confederate flag hung over the state capitol, where nearly 10% of the students were African American, where they were having the church burnings in the mid-1990s. And I concluded that I needed to redirect my research efforts to bring them into line with my embeddedness, my social setting there. And I started researching the history of my school, its history in relationship to segregation. And after doing that, I was invited to lead our faculty retreat focused on this history. It is doing research that a seminary faculty said, oh, we want to know. What did you find out? Tell us. And then right about then, I moved to Trinity. And I discovered nobody was interested in spiritual warfare. And so I could have kept researching it, but with no social supports and interest. But in my very first meal, I ate with Peter Chow, David Powell, Bruce Fields, T.T., and I discovered that Trinity, with 50 faculty, for 12 years, it had one ethnic minority, Dr. Bruce Fields. And then finally, just recently, it added three more. And that there was a great deal of interest in how do we do theological education in a racially and ethnically diverse world. I said, why don't we get some funding to have a conversation, to do what we did with spiritual warfare in Colombia? And Peter Chow said, you get the money, we'll do it. So we sent a small grant, $2,500, that meets every 2 weeks for banquet, for discussion, not a lot of work, but the people who were there were energized on this. Not spiritual warfare, this was what was cutting edge of their interest. Later, we pulled in some Wheaton faculty and then brainstormed, how about a several-year project where we keep working on? How about if we work on a writing project? Let's write a grant to the Wabash Center for $20,000. Let's get the president of our school, who keeps preaching that this is what matters, let's see if he'll put his money where his mouth is. Greg Wakebright, can you help us? Well, I'm not sure I can. He said, I know what, let's talk to the president of the Free Church. Because he's preaching this as well. And so Peter Chow and I, together with Greg Wakebright, sat down with the president of the Free Church, and we said, if Wabash should give us the $20,000, will you match it? He said, I'll do it. I don't know where it's going to come from, but I'll do it. Wheaton came, kicked through. Once it became a fully Wheaton project, as well as a Trinity, with another $15,000, and some others came otherwise. For a 3 or 4 year project, mainly Wheaton and Trinity faculty, but a few others, Dr. Marlo Frederick, an anthropologist at Harvard, evangelical Christian, Janelle Paris. We stacked our group with as many anthropologists and sociologists as we could, and then filled the rest out with a few Bible scholars, theologians, church historians. and it was nice to be the editor, right? He had a little control. and then published again with Oxford University. What I'm suggesting is that when one directs one's research efforts in ways that coincide with the priorities of others, there's a fruitful synergy that is often created. Often you mobilize support from surprising directions. It helps to create recognition of your own work and new opportunities in other directions. More recently, I focused on short-term missions, not because, as I say, I started off by saying, boy, this is the best way to reach the world, but just because that's where the action is for so many people. But again, there was some funding that was available, and the interest has been, I get at least once a month a telephone call from journalists, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, etc., that is there. The right topics often generate. So here in anthropology, you have the anthropology of tourism, huge arena. You have the anthropology of pilgrimage, pretty big, anthropology, sociology of pilgrimage. But the United States has probably 2+ million North American Christians traveling abroad every year on short-term mission trips, average of 8 days abroad. And none of the social scientists or sociologists have been doing research on that. Here's a topic. It's a great topic. It makes perfect sense to do research on it. It would be, you know, Christians have an inside track on social access and other sorts of things. Okay, I began by talking about the challenge of vocation. Building a coherent life where disciplinary research is central, where our interests and priorities are lived out in our work, and where this is embedded in a larger system of transcendent meaning, which for me, like many of you, is oriented towards God, the scriptures, the church, and the mission of God in the world. To have a sense of vocation is a wonderful thing. Duty and desire merge, becoming one. Each of us will live and work in work settings that differ markedly from each other. But I do hope some of this proves helpful to you as you continue to grapple with the practical challenges of how to actually construct a life congruent with fundamental vocational commitments where social science is a part of a God-given calling and lived out within the framework of the transcendent relevance structure. Thank you.